are joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, welcoming you to the natural nurse and Dr. Z. And we have all kinds of events going on for the summer where we go outside and gather edible and medicinal local plants and make them into medicine. Do you know how to make your own herb infusion or tincture or extract? Do you know the difference between an herbal extract and an herbal tincture? Do you know what to use? The plants that grow right outside right now for seasonal allergies. For instance, wherever you live in our area, you can find such things as dandelion and nettle. And they are actually very useful, along with decreasing wheat consumption, to deal with seasonal allergies, which so many people suffer from this time of year. So it's great if you want to join us. Just go to naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. Look under schedule, and you can come right up and join us. And joining us today as our guest is Chelsea Mirando. Chelsea's background includes a BA in American History, studies in environmental sciences, marine biology, biofuels, and agri-sciences. Chelsea and her family faced economic ruin, like many Americans did, in the economic downturn, when both she and her husband lost their jobs. Chelsea, however, really grabbed the bulls by the proverbial horns and turned challenge into opportunity. She rallied her resources and decided to rebuild by establishing Mirando Farms. Mirando Farms is the only working farm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and it's a one-acre urban farm in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Mirando Farms has become a hub resource in the community with 42 rescued farm animals, fresh organic grown food, hydroponic growing, aquaculture, and soil-based methods, which we're going to discuss, a monthly co-op, CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture, beekeeping, rain harvesting, initiation of community gardens with schools, churches, and private and public organizations. Mirando Farms helps organizations foster the passion of where food comes from and how to grow it. And I had the delight of visiting Chelsea on her farm just a few months ago. So thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Hey, Ellen, thank you so much for having me.
It's really, really a pleasure. Now, I know that you had another whole life, so why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what happened that led you to create Mirando Farms?
Funny story. Back
I'm sure it's funnier now than it was at
yeah,
the
right?
time.
And then at the time. Absolutely. My husband and I, we were both in the construction world. I ran a company that was all construction fastening systems. We sold everything that it took to build huge buildings, even small buildings. But everything it takes to build a building besides concrete, steel, and lumber. So everything else we sold. And we worked the Tri-County area. We had 17 sales reps. And when construction failed, so did the business. Nobody was buying any construction materials anymore. And it just went downhill from there. My husband had lost his job in April, and I lost mine at the end of September in the year 2009. So with that being said, you lose your company car, you lose your health insurance, you lose your livelihood, your day-to-day resources that you take for granted. And we were just trying to figure out what to do next. First and foremost, I had gone back and started working on my master's, thinking that I could at least go back and teach.
And what were you looking for a master's in?
I started my master's in American history. But then found myself drawn to more biological sciences, and I took a few classes here, and then more ag sciences. environmental sciences. So I was just completely drawn towards that and not so much American history anymore. So then I just started taking a few classes, and I had actually seen the transition of construction for about a year prior to me losing my job. So my bosses, the owners of the company, had said, "Chelsea, we've got to cut your salary in half." And I still stayed around, but I said, "Well, I got to take a day off of work then," and I was going back to school. So I did that for about a year, or maybe 18 months. So I had taken a bunch of courses at the local university and just tried to start picking up to see, is this going to get better, and just sort of, you know, pursue my options at that point. And more and more, I just started changing, you know, and decided to get into more of some marine biologies and environmental sciences. And with that, it just sort of turned a whole new leaf. I lost my job. We started meeting farmers. We were doing soil sciences out of different farms. I was learning how people were going from conventional growing to organic growing, really passionate about the organics. And, you know, my husband and myself, we had always had a garden. My parents have always had gardens. So a lot of the stuff that we were doing was just hobbyists. Making biodiesel was just the hobby, you know, taking
our... Well, let's not go through that so easily. Let's go into, you know, biodiesel is a growing field, and I think one of the things that might make the use of fuel sustainable in the future. And you have a beautiful little setup, and everything that you did, like we did introduce you talking about 1 acre, you have all this going on in 1 acre.
Yes, ma'am, we
that
do.
That is amazing. It feels much bigger when you're there because you did such great planning design with sort of different areas, but they're all very self-contained, but they produce a tremendous amount of food, and there's a huge amount of community involvement.
We couldn't do it without our community. We really couldn't. We wouldn't be here today if we didn't have such a wonderful, wonderful community as the city of Fort Lauderdale. I mean, you know, everybody has just rallied, and, you know, and now even the city of Fort Lauderdale has a wonderful sustainability community and committee, and they're really getting involved. I the city of Fort Lauderdale, you just wait, we'll be the new green city.
And it's wonderful because where you established this farm, which has beautiful, delicious fresh vegetables, is really quite in the middle of more of an urban area, which may have been referred to previously as an urban desert. So tell us what an urban desert means, in a food desert.
Well, food deserts are empty plots of land, owned primarily, it's just an empty desert where it actually is able to produce. Well, then it varies. A lot of people's idea varies on what a food desert is. What we decide a food desert is, what I decide a food desert is an area that could produce local, healthy, fresh produce, organic, in an area where people do not have access to healthy foods. And we've also done a few studies back in 2010 and 2011 with the university and Anthony Oliveri. We produced a study that we took every zip code in Broward County, and what they tried to figure out was who had the highest diabetes, the highest heart disease, who were the sickest people in the community, and why were they? Because they didn't have access to fresh, healthy foods. They didn't have a Publix or a Winn-Dixie or a Whole Foods right down the street from them, nor could they mostly afford that. They were poor, depressed neighborhoods, and without fresh fruits available to them. So they're eating prepared foods at the liquor store, or the, you know, going to the CVS's or Walgreens of the world. And they don't
have
a reason
to have
that.
So you were able to actually relate a higher incidence of disease to the unavailability of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was done through a grant through the Broward Regional Health Planning Council and TOUCH. TOUCH is a program through the BRHPC, which is transforming our community's health.
Isn't that great? So you
it
were
is.
Able to document that, and then you used it to obtain fundings to create, you know, this piece of land, which, like we said, was only 1 acre, was not being used for growing food. It was just kind of almost more of a waste dump.
Correct. Yes, it is considered a brown site, so everything is grown above ground. So, yeah. And being able to turn that into an organic farm and, you know, right down from capturing rainwater and, yeah.
Now, is the farm actually, is it actually certified organic? Because that's kind of expensive to actually get that certification.
That certification is very expensive. And, you know, Ellen, to be perfectly honest, I just can't even, I don't even follow the USDA certification anymore. But no, we use natural practices. We make our own compost teas. I know because I'm the farmer.
Exactly.
So I know how
and
it's grown.
I
know
what
that
I right.
produce, correct, I produce food better than USDA organic because you are allowed a certain amount of pesticides or herbicides or fungicides in
right, and the cost would make it prohibitive for you to offer your beautiful foods to the community
correct.
At such a reasonable price.
Correct.
So you don't need the
certification. Have to, right. In the communities where we are producing this food, we do have to accept food stamps. And a lot of this was learning, you know, learning what the community needed and learning what the community wanted. And, you know, it's taken us a few years to get it right. But to be able to document all this stuff, you know, to be able to document being in the low-income housing projects and being able to grow the food and give it back to the community at such a fair price or using their food stamps or a food voucher program by getting somebody within the community that, you know, these people normally wouldn't come down to the market or would come down and buy the fresh produce. But you have wonderful people in the community like the Community Foundation of Broward who will create a voucher program and they'll give everybody in the housing project $5 coupons to come down and buy the food. And
how hard was it for you to get certified to accept food stamps and vouchers?
Wasn't hard
I mean, is there a fee or just a lot of work involved in that?
You know, I mean, you know, working with the government, it takes a little bit of time. So, once we saw the need and we understood what was happening, it takes a good 90, 120 days to be able to implement that into, you know, the project. But, Sharon Yeago, who is our farmers market guru here, she has just done amazing things and she's, you know, put these all over the state of Florida, and she's just been really instrumental in helping us acquire the grant and to follow the parameters of the grant that the USDA gave us.
Oh, that's excellent. So once you've got that in place, then it's easier. People can actually come there with vouchers, with food stamps, and, of course, cash, because for any price, I bought food at your farm, and there was actually nothing better. It was absolutely excellent.
We work hard at it. You know, the community works hard at it. Our volunteers work hard at it. Our, you know, couple of employees that we have, they put in extra time just to make it run. It is, there's not a lot of money in it. We don't do it to get rich. We do it to educate and make ourselves and our community healthier and stronger. And that was really, you know, the point when we lost our jobs and we lost our health insurance. You know, that was a little bit scary because we'd always taken for granted that we'd have it. And then to not have your health insurance, you're kind of taking a step back like, gosh, what if we did get sick? So, I mean, the first and foremost, we took all the garbage out of the house and did everything organic. And it was the first thing that I could do to make sure that I had control of the kids' foods or whatever that was they were shoving in their mouth. We made so many sacrifices. There was no money to go out and have dinner with friends. So the money was used to having to buy grass-fed beef or pastured poultry. I was lucky enough that I was able to meet farmers who were doing it for us. I met some other moms, like moms in Broward. We started our own co-op where we had to buy shares of a cow. And we all chipped in money and we sent our grass-fed cow to the butcher and, you know, and came back and we all got, you know, a fifth of a cow. But at least we knew the farmer. We knew how it was raised. Our chickens were corn and soy free because we know all about GMOs. And that's a whole nother topic.
That really is. And there's a very big movement in Florida and other states now, again, to try to once again get labeling of GMOs on the ballot, which I think is of the utmost importance. Although, of course, you probably know that Monsanto actually won a very big case yesterday.
Don't get me started.
Don't know. Yeah. So,
they're the devil incarnate.
It seems like it. It seems like it, because I couldn't believe they actually won that case against a farmer. Since you're a farmer, I'm sure you would can see how he got actually totally railroaded, because they have just huge, endless amounts of money and seem to be moving towards owning the world. But what you did is, instead of worry about a big social issue, you actually took an acre of land, which was
correct,
locally. It somehow became available to you. That was a great story about how it became available to you. And then you put together, I mean, you actually went for a degree in diesel mechanics, I remember, while you were pregnant.
I did. I actually dropped out of the class as soon as I got to the point where I needed to be, because I just didn't have time. And I was, like, 7 months pregnant, so I didn't have time to finish the course. And I wanted to get the project done before I had the baby. So so I just took the course to figure out, yes, diesel mechanics. And we had dabbled around with it on, like, lawnmowers as kids. And, you know, we blew up stuff all the time. It's me and a couple guys from high school. And but when I started to convert our vehicles, our diesel trucks, over to WVO and bio, waste veggie oil is WVO, where we just filter it. And
okay, well, let's talk about that, because you showed me basically tanks right there on your property.
Right.
Where
the community, right, the community comes, and we have this great big, huge 250-gallon rain barrel that we just use as our waste veggie oil tank. And the community just comes and they dump in their tank. And when it gets all filled up, and even restaurants come sometimes and drop off containers full of their waste veggie oil. And so they come and they drop it off. And once we fill up, you know, about 250 gallons, fill up a tank, we just use a simple grease pump to pump it out. And then we filter it by using 55-gallon steel drums and propane. And we set it up, and we just filter it three times by using the simple grease pump that we've seen to manufacture, and PVC. And it's very simple. And then we store it. And then we have a vortex that we put the clean veggie oil in, and we very simply do a little chemistry experiment by, you know, some sodium phosphate, some methanol, you know, this and that. And the glycerin settles to the bottom of our vortex, and we sludge that out, and we put the glycerin in 5-gallon buckets, set it to the side. And we use the biodiesel and store it in a tank, and then we have a little gas pump that we pump it into our vehicle.
Pretty now, what easy kind of vehicle do you use? And that's free fuel then.
Right, we have an F-350 diesel flatbed. It's our farm truck, and we use that. So
you use this reconstituted vegetable oil
that
people were going to just throw out or dump into the wherever, And
right.
now mm-hmm. it's being transformed right there, right at your place, with something that, how much did it cost to set up the system to make that happen? The system that you pour the oil into and then to sort of process it into usable fuel?
The whole system itself? The biggest thing was the two tanks, the vortex tank, and otherwise the rest of the stuff was just picked up and got donated, like we went up to Publix, and I'm trying to think. I think it probably cost us about $1,500.
Okay, so that's a reasonable amount if you think about sort of having free fuel forever after that, which is
right? Well,
a wonderful
I mean,
investment.
The methanol is our only really cost, and the methanol, so like per gallon, it probably cost us about 58 cents a gallon
that's
to
amazing.
Produce and make.
That is amazing. Well, we're going to just take a little short break right here, and we are talking to Chelsea Miranda about her wonderful project. I highly advise you to visit the website, which is Mirando, M-A-R-A-N-D-O, MirandoFarms.com, or better yet, when you're in Florida, come down and visit. It's an amazing, amazing experience, and we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, it should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into the Natural Medicine Chest.
And welcome back. You're here with The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is Gary Null's network. And one of the wonderful things about Progressive Radio is that you can tune in at your convenience. We love you to listen live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. right here on PRN.FM. But you can check in any time, day or night. Just go to PRN.FM and click on Archives and scroll down to N for Natural Nurse if you'd like to join us. And, of course, you'll view all the other wonderful shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. Today we are having a discussion with a real community leader in Fort Lauderdale, and that's Chelsea Mirando. And I visited Chelsea at MirandoFarms.com recently and was very, very impressed that she took a piece of property that was basically a wasteland and is only 1 acre. When you're there, you feel like it goes on forever. And it's right in the downtown area of Fort Lauderdale. And she has an amazing amount of projects going on there. Chelsea, you just described to us the biofuel area. Let's talk about that fabulous aquaculture room that has quaa and tilapia and all these beautiful, completely natural and organic vegetables growing all together and depending on each other.
Right, yes, that was our last year big summer project. Now that we always had, my parents have a pond in the back, in their backyard, so we kind of dabbled in it here and there. And it was always something that I was, you know, found an interest in. And then, of course, when we acquired this property and turned into my playground, I was able to play and try on a few different things. But lucky for me, I met this fantastic marine engineer that was just as passionate and saw my little system, and he goes, how do we take this to the next level? And his name's Colin Bennett, and he's amazing and so super smart, and found us some funding to help implement the project. And since then, we have this amazing aquaculture. We've got 3 ponds. Two with filled with koi and 1 large pond. I believe we've got 2 150-gallon ponds of koi, and then we have 1 300-gallon pond of tilapia. And these three.
Now, when you say a pond, I want to describe it a little bit because, of course, we're on the radio, so people can't see them. I wouldn't call it a pond. I guess that's the word for it because this is not something that people can visualize as a pond that's in the ground.
Right.
More like a giant, giant fish tank, kind of, but it's made out of metal, and then it has a window where you can see these beautiful, healthy fish swimming around in it.
Correct, yes. They're big tubs, plastic tubs, and we did put, so the kids could actually be able to see the fish and understand the concept. Because we do about 400 to 500 different school tours throughout the school season. And as we're trying to explain it to the children, how it works, these 3 particular ponds are staggered. One is high, the next one is about 6 inches lower, and then the next one is about 6 inches lower than that. And what Colin had helped create was the flow of gravity and how water just wants to naturally self-level itself. So we would flow, instead of using a lot of electricity, since we didn't have that, we went ahead and we used just gravity. So we would have, we have the one pond flowing into the other pond, flowing into the other pond. And then we used a simple PVC to be able to suck the fish excrement out of it to be able to feed our next, our entire garden. So we have, and then we just try to explain how these particular gardens work. When we talk about medium, medium is what holds the plant upright, whether you're using a hydroponics and a coconut core or you're using soil to hold the plant upright, soil as in dirt, or you're using, we use river rock in the aquaponics, We also use clay balls, known as crete, to hold the plant upright. And then we also have even these little net pots that just float in trays in two long extended ponds. So just to give everybody an idea, we grow a myriad of different ways on the farm and just try to show how differently in whatever situation you're in that medium doesn't have to be soil-based.
Well, I want to describe that room a little more because it was just magical to me to see it. So as you said, Chelsea, you had these three ponds. We'll call them ponds because I'm sure that's the official term, although they kind of look more like freestanding, very, very large kind of fish tank things with windows that built in, like you said, so you can clearly describe and show exactly what's going on there. Then in the same room, you have raised beds where all these plants are growing that look like they're just going to jump out of the into your mouth. I mean, they're just so green and so vibrant and so healthy. Nothing like what you would see on a commercial farm that uses pesticides and herbicides and no real dirt and bees that are dying off. I mean, it's just the essence of living. It's the essence of being able to interact with a living system that works so beautifully together. And then I believe that the plants were sort of just in water because you pulled some up right by the roots and put them right back in.
Right. Yep. We just had floating trays that sat on top of the water with a little net pot, a little 2-inch pot that sat inside a floating styrofoam tray just to hold it upright. And then what happens is the roots are flowing in the water, and once the plant matures, then the root base also matures and grows to be anywhere from, you know, 6 inches to 2 feet long, and it just flows in the water. But that root is actual the natural cleansing of the water. So it cleans any bacteria from the fish excrement is the fertilizer, so to speak, for the plants to be able to grow. And then the root base is the natural cleansing of the water. So it oxygenates the water. It cleans it of any bacteria. And it's just a natural process, which just works in nature. And then the fish have enough oxygenated water and clean water. The system is completely circular. So the only time we have to add water, and we use rainwater when we add the water to the system, is through evaporation.
So now, it seems pretty warm in there, but obviously it's Florida, so you're not heating the water. But it seems a little warm. I know it was sort of covered with plastic in this whole just area where the fish tank and the plants were interacting.
Correct. And we also use plastic because we don't want to adjust our pHs around the hoop house. So everything is inside a hoop house. And then the hoop house is covered in plastic. And then we also have a Mylar shade cloth, which really allows it to stay approximately about 10 to 15 degrees cooler than it is outside that hoop house.
Well, everybody in there looked happy. And when I say everybody, participants looking in and the fish themselves looking out of the window at the people looking at them, and the plants were just so vibrant and so green and so delicious. And it seems like many, many people could have that, like in a small backyard. People pay more than what it costs to set that up just by putting a fancy patio in.
Sure, sure. And we were lucky enough to be able to call in to come in and help us put it all together. And he's been fortunate enough that he's created a business and we've created jobs, which was, you know, something in this economy that's not exactly easy to do. So people are becoming more and more aware of where their food's coming from, where they want their food to come from, or taking the initiative to growing their own food. And it has been wonderful. We do lots of do-it-yourself classes to where you're able to come to a 2-day weekend course, and it's all day, you know, from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, but by the time you leave, you'll get your certification and be able to build your own and get the tools to be able to build your own aquaculture garden in the back. We've been really, really, really fortunate that we were able to do that.
And in a place like Florida, this can go on all year round. But how about in more temperate areas, like in New York, would the fish ponds freeze in the winter?
Yes, they could freeze. However, you do have heated pools, and they have like heated wire that would go around just to keep the water temperate. But lots of people do it in their basements. And the largest producer, Cheapers, in the entire nation, he does it all on 3 acres, and it's all aquaponics. He was a University of Miami graduate, and I can't remember his name at the moment. But he's up in Michigan, and he grows about 1 million pounds of food quite rapidly on 3 acres.
That's just amazing. Have you eaten any of that tilapia right out of your tank?
We actually, our tilapia tank, we got our aquaculture certification. We built it last summer in June, and we finally got our aquaculture certification in November, which allowed us to legally buy the fingerlings that we put into the tank. That's why we used the koi first, just to get our pHs and get everything on the up and up in order to get our certification before we called the state in. And so our tilapia are just about ready to harvest. We haven't harvested any yet, but we're really looking forward to it. So our tilapia, it takes from a fingerling to harvest, takes approximately 9 to 10 months.
And then, once you have those, you're starting the smaller ones, so then it's an ongoing availability.
Right, right. We'll sell the koi now out of one tank, and we'll make one a tilapia breeding pond. So we'll have, you know, they'll just be able to breed in one pond, and then it'll be a constant, cost-effective
source of food for the community, and if someone had it at their house for their family, and, you know, like you said, then it develops into a business, so just all good. So we're going to take another break right here on Progressive Radio Network, listeners, and we're going to identify some of the other fabulous shows that are right here on Progressive Radio Network, and when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion with Chelsea Mirando of Mirando Farms, and you can find her at mirandofarms.com. Or stop by when you're in Fort Lauderdale. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And thank you so much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we'd like to thank you for joining us every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., right here on Progressive Radio Network. And, of course, you can find this show as well as all the other shows you just heard about and lots of other shows right here at prn.fm when you go to the archives. And today, we have as our guest Chelsea Mirando. We're talking about so many topics, and I'm sure if you're listening, you're surprised, and I want to remind you, this is all on a one-acre urban farm in downtown Fort Lauderdale. This is not way out in Ohio where she has 50 acres to, you know, just walk around on, but it has actually become a hub resource in the community with 42 rescued farm animals that we're going to talk about, fresh organic food grown with hydroponics. We talked about the hydroponics and the growing of tilapia and the roots filtering out all the nutrients of the plants and also acting as a water filter in the aquaculture area. And also she has monthly co-ops, CSAs, which is community-supported agriculture, beekeeping, rain harvesting. These are all things that you can do both in your home and in your community. She has started community gardens with schools, churches, and private public organizations, and all of this was initiated by her need and her husband's need to continue to support their family. So it really, you know, tragedy sort of led you in a wonderful direction, wouldn't you say, Chelsea?
Yeah. It's been a fantastic ride. And
you work hard, I'll say that. This is not like you're not a gentlewoman farmer, I'll say that. You're out there actually working and then also organizing, and then you have workers, so you're supporting others through your initiative also. Now, let's talk about how you became an animal rescue, because that's, I don't even know how you fit 42 farm animals.
Holy
and they're all
muck.
In one little area.
I know.
And they look so happy, too.
You know what? We've been really blessed. The first pigs and chickens that showed up were 2 days after Christmas, so it was about the 27th of December, 3 years ago. And Fred and I show up, and it's still dark out, and we see a couple dog crates, and we said, oh, Lord. You know, we call our name is Mirando Farms, and now people are going to start leaving their dogs and cats. You know, and we're going to have to become a rescue. Little did we know, there were pigs and chickens inside those dog crates. And we brought them in and gave them some water and whatever, you know, we could scrape up around and made sure they were fed. And sure enough, we ran right up the street from us is the Wildlife Care Center. So I said, let's load them in the truck and let's go up to the Wildlife Care Center, and it was pretty early in the morning. So we thought we'd go up there and catch the doctor or something and drop them off and see if somebody would be able to take care of them, because at the time when we got them, we were still running landscaping businesses and working from sun up till sundown, so we didn't have time to take care of any more animals. And they said, we are completely booked, Chelsea. There is... You've got to take and care for these for just a little while. We have so many animals, and I guess, you know, there's a lot of irresponsibility out there.
So you're telling me you came out and there were pigs dropped off at your door?
Yes, in dog crates. We thought that there would be dogs and cats in there, but no, there was two big dog crates, and there was two pigs and two roosters and two chickens.
Maybe somebody, you know, had them for pets and had to move and couldn't take pigs with them or something.
They left a note saying that it was a Christmas present gone wrong. I guess he thought for his girlfriend he was doing the right thing and wanted to give her a farm, and then realized, well, this is a bit more than they could chew. So with that being said, we acquired two Vietnamese potbelly pigs and two beautiful roosters, show roosters, and then two a Japanese hen, and they were gorgeous birds. So since they had no room to take us, we brought them back to the farm, and my husband spent the morning, you know, trying to fix a little pen, and we were just trying to make them safe, and then they'd escape, and we'd put them back in, and they'd escape, and we'd put them back in, and we said, oh, for Pete's sake. But little by little, people just started dropping off bunnies. We've got three bunny rabbits, and I think we've got five Florida box turtles, and we have a tortoise that somebody's dropped off. And, of course, you know, it's all anonymous. And then,
so nobody drops off a donation with these animals.
But every once in a while, somebody will drop off a bag of food because they, you know, so we don't know where it comes from, but we graciously take it on because, you know, we've got to make sure they're all under veterinarian care, and that's a big expense for a farmer, you know.
That's for sure. Now, are there any veterinarians who maybe will donate services since this is a community action network, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. We've been so blessed by the Wildlife Care Center. They're literally, you know, 10 blocks up the street from us, and they come over. We donate produce to them for their animals. And Dr. Snyder has been an amazing, and she pops in. They do all their shopping here. So all the volunteers and everybody over at the care center comes over to us, and, you know, they'll walk around and take a look, and they make sure all the animals are healthy and happy, and everybody here, they said, you know, your animals are happier here than in our place. So, you know, it's...
So they were happy to have you, because what they kind of did is, since they were already incorporated and set up, they sort of just expanded into also using this area you have.
This is true. I mean, like I said, we didn't have, you know, there's not a lot of money, so you barter with what you can, and you do what you need to do for other organizations to receive some support from them. It's just how the community works.
Now, also, in terms of interacting with the community, tell us what a CSA is and how yours is set up.
Correct. A CSA is Community Supported Agriculture, and that means within the community we use community farmers that in turn grow shares of food for the individual who has invested into their farm. We accept about 100 members to our CSA. Last year, this was my second year, and we said that we would take 50. Last year was our first year. We had 33 members. This year I said we'll take 50. We took 88. And next year I say we can only do 100 because it's so much work. But, you know, who knows?
Well, when somebody joins a CSA, so they have to pay a certain fee. And they're kind of taking a risk, whatever their money, you know, God forbid, let's hope not, but should there be a hurricane or something that interferes with your ability to produce all that organic food, they lose their money. But if you have a bumper crop, they get tons of produce. How it works.
Correct. Absolutely. That's exactly how it works. And we were so blessed this year, you know. Our one tomato farmer had put up hoop houses, and Hurricane Sandy came in, and it was a tropical storm for us here in Florida. But in that hoop house, it did create a vortex, and it wiped out every single tomato plant on his particular farm. So he had to start over. So we lost about 8 weeks of tomato growing because he had to replant. That happened in October. So, So with that being said, other than that, we had no freezes in South Florida. It was a wonderful, just blessing of a year. And in our CSA basket, so we work with about 17 different naturally grown, pesticide-free, some certified organic farms within Florida. Mostly central and South Florida. And in turn, we invest into the farmer, and in turn, they grow shares of crops for us. And it was amazing.
Well, that's a good way to work, because you certainly can't support 80 CSA members on 1 acre.
Correct, right. So, we grow what we can here, and we grow for our market, mm-hmm. but on 1 acre. But, you know, throughout Broward County, we've probably got about 15 acres that we're growing in different areas, whether we're in Dania or we're at Northwest Gardens or we're out in Lauderdale Lakes or Dixie Court or out in Davie. So we do have garden plots in food deserts all over the city.
See, that's so fabulous. So your concept is growing. First of all, bringing delicious, reasonably priced organic food to consumers. Second, working on creating new jobs, because each of those land plots, people have to grow stuff on them.
Absolutely.
So things that were just sitting there, you know, maybe just with broken bottles and, you know, people using illicit drugs and who knows what, is now becoming an area that gives more oxygen into the environment, gives healthy organic food, gives jobs. I mean, it's so win-win that it should be how our entire economy is really set up.
Absolutely. If we just went back to basics, this country was built on agriculture. So to think that at any point in time, another country who, say Mexico, has a shift in power to where they decide not to send us food anymore, we'd be in a world of trouble. We'd be in a world of eating a lot of corn and a lot of soy that's all genetically modified. So getting back to basics, and don't get ahead of yourself. Create a small garden. Do container gardening. Put some pretty pots. Put some herbs. Start there and just start with herbs or a single tomato plant. Bake it up and have fresh tomatoes and fresh basil and a little oleo and, you know, balsamic, and you've got a wonderful salad. So, I mean, there's simple things that we can do to, change our eating habits, our health, and, it stinks we had for years taken for granted, and I come from a family of farmers, but I'm so glad that everything happens for a reason and that we were able to change our lifestyles and work with our community and change theirs, and with their support, their learning. And
now, talking about the community, another big educational niche that you fill is working with the schools and bringing in school tours. What happens when these kids come? I mean, some of them certainly think that meat is only, on a plastic tray, and vegetables are only in cans, if they're lucky.
This is true, and this is an epidemic. So when they come here, we always make sure that they try fresh fruits and vegetables. I ask them what their favorite fresh fruit and vegetable is, along with everything else in line that we do here on the farm. But getting these children to eat closer to nature and closer to the earth. In some neighborhoods, we ask the kids, what's your favorite fruit? And they tell us it's a fruit roll-up or a fruit cup.
That happens everywhere. It's true.
And, and you're just beside yourself. And bologna is steak or whatever. I mean, there's the kids are so disconnected from their food source that they have no idea even where it comes from or what's in it. And it's, as a parent, our responsibility to read the ingredients. And
or not have any ingredients, which is better, because if there's
exactly.
No ingredients, then it's a piece of food. Organic
exactly.
Would
read
be best.
Ingredients. If you can pronounce them all, then holy smokes, but I can't, so I don't know what it is. I don't buy it.
So, that's a good rule of thumb. Now, how do you set that up? Because this doesn't just happen that schools show up. I mean, there's a lot of background organizational work that has to happen there.
Sure. Well, the teachers, we are contacted and we are listed as one of the field trips through the Tri-County School Board system. And a lot of different organizations want to come and either volunteer or come and get a farm tour. And, we charge a very small fee, $4, and all the chaperones are free, $4 per student, which you can get anybody to underwrite. And then they come and they have a wonderful farm tour, and they get to see the animals, and they get to taste honey from the bee apiary that
now,
we have.
Now, how does that
back.
Work? Aren't you worried, and don't you need a lot of insurance in case a student gets stung by a bee?
Yeah, we tell them not to swat. the bees are not angry bees. They're very happy on the farm here. They're
and
very
you're not
docile.
Having colony collapse syndrome there, I bet, with them actually having real flowers to go to and real food to eat.
It's true. I don't have to worry about it, but we have many, many, many bee farmers that, ship their bees up to Maine or over to Texas and the Midwest, and they drop off 50,000 hives and come back and have one or two left, if any. It's It's a cry and shame of what's happening out there. And they know what it is, and, you know, this is their livelihood. And then to lose it, it's pretty scary.
It's so true.
I mean, if we don't have any bees, we don't have any food.
And your bees just buzz around right by the hive. And all this, by the way, listeners, all of these things that Chelsea has spoken about here today, and there's a lot more to talk about, but unfortunately we're running out of time. But you're talking about rain barrels, special growing materials that are useful, and drip irrigation. There's so much to learn. Shade cloth, because of course you're in Florida. But we talked about CSAs. We talked about agriculture, and we talk about aquaponics, tremendous amount of things going on that helps the community, that helps Chelsea. She's able to support her family. You're not getting real rich with this, but at least it's honest work, and you're creating employment for other people, and that's just sort of a good side effect of the whole project. So I am very impressed with what you have been doing, and I would like to support our listeners in visiting Mirando Farms. You can visit it virtually at mirandofarms.com, or go ahead and visit it when you're in Florida. It's a wonderful, healthy, enjoyable field trip for the day. And this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, reminding you, you can always find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we are wishing you the best, and stay healthy.